And I'd like to welcome you to the third lecture of our 68th season. May I just give you a word about memberships? And I'd like to strike a balance on memberships. Since the Institute started in 1916, the Institute has been very keen on not pressuring people to commit themselves financially to come in order to come to the lectures. The lectures are designed to be quality lectures, free to anyone who's interested in coming. At the same time, we are dependent upon the memberships to finance the work of the Institute. I said last week that I would give you some feeling about the numbers in respect of memberships. Last year we had a total of 754. Now what that means in terms of numbers, I won't break down to you because, as you know, family memberships count for two. But we had 754 total memberships sold last fiscal year, last academic year. To date, we have sold 365 memberships. At this time last year, we had sold 333, so that we're ahead of where we were last year. And in that sense, I thank you for the Institute. At the same time, I remind you that we are anxious to have students at $2, single memberships at $10, and family memberships at $15 taken out. Let me again thank the Cecil H. and Ida Green Visiting Professorships Committee, whose support has enabled the Institute to bring to you Dr. Alexander Kazhdin, who I welcome tonight on your behalf. Dr. and Mrs. Kazhdin have enjoyed their few days in sunny Vancouver. They will be celebrating on the 6th of October, or the 8th of October, the 6th anniversary of their emigration to the West. Dr. Kazhdin now has at Barton Oak Center of Byzantine Research in Washington, D.C., exactly the same academic responsibilities that he had at the Academy of Sciences in Moscow when he and Mrs. Kazhdin decided to emigrate, follow their mathematician son to the West. So that in introducing Dr. Kazhdin to the Institute tonight, I'm going to talk about his and my meeting earlier today. And I'm mindful of what he said to me, and if I can, I'll quote, "My biography reflects the general features of all of the intellectuals of my generation in Russia. When I was persecuted, all of the Jews were persecuted. When I had to go to the provinces in 1947 to get work, everyone had to. When I was able to move my field of study after the death of Stalin in 1953 from social and agrarian economics to cultural and religious studies, everyone could. We're not conscious in our community of academics' research being influenced by political powers. Dr. Kazhdin is today the Western world's foremost authority on the study of the history of the Eastern Roman Empire and the Eastern or Russian Orthodox Church. His formal senior schooling started in 1939. You will remember that Germany did not invade Russia until 1941. Dr. Kazhdin's inherited short-sightedness kept him from the army. While working in the war effort, he continued his studies after the German invasion, obtaining his MA, or its equivalent, in 1943. He completed his first thesis defense in 1946 on a paper entitled Agrarian Relationships in Late Byzantine Period, and his second thesis in 1961, Town and Country Life in the 9th and 10th Century Byzantine. After completing his first thesis, he was qualified to join the Academy of Sciences in Moscow. That was not, however, to happen. The anti-Semitic policies of Stalin were by 1946-47 well developed. There was nothing written. It was, as Dr. Kazhdin says, a word. It was in the air. There was no formal policy, but the word was cosmopolitanism. In the spirit of the times, he was denied a place at the Academy of Sciences, but permitted a place in a small academy in the country. This position he took up in 1947. You may know that 1949 was a year of crisis for all of the Jews in Russia. In Dr. Kasdan's small town, that crisis perpetuated itself by the arrest of a group of four, including Dr. Kasdan. They were considered to be cosmopolitan lecturers. They were dismissed from their jobs and arrested and faced a very difficult period. Cosmopolitans were described as those who disturbed the unity of the state by crawling on their knees before the pseudo-Western civilization. There was, of course, great terror on the part of everyone involved. The arresters had to be seen to be doing their jobs, and those arrested, you can understand. It's a longish story, full of interest, but one of the four, a lady, a loyal believer, and a member of the Communist Party, and the system, was so grief-stricken by her betrayal that she suicided. The shock of the suicide caused the authorities to release the other three, including Dr. Kasdan, who said to me this morning, "I believe strongly that the tragedy of her suicide saved my life." In any event, his persecution ceased. The penalty of being a cosmopolitan continued. It was reduced to that of being dismissed from his position with a prohibition against teaching. Now, you know that Stalin died in March of 1953. The death of Stalin literally again saved our speaker's life. Not only did the planning for the execution of Russian Jewry stop, but it brought about the practicality of academic work being done by our speaker and all other intellectuals of his generation in areas other than the history of the Communist Party. It permitted the study of the whole of the cultural and religious influences of the medieval and the Byzantine cultures on modern Russia. The death of Stalin in 1953, despite its importance, did not end the difficulty for Dr. Kasdan. They continued until 1956, when he was at last admitted to the Academy of Sciences. I'll stop there and say simply that 8 years ago, Dr. Kasdan arrived in Vienna on his way to the West. He earned money by offering himself to lecture in, as he described it, bad English or bad French. In the 8 years that he's been in the West, I can frankly say that he has worked on our society with his lectures and writing, enriching us immensely. On behalf of the Institute, I ask him to lecture to the topic Byzantine culture. Dr. Kasdan.
Why Byzantium? I think many of you have asked this question. Why should we listen to a lecture about Byzantium? What have we to do with this country and with this culture that ceased to exist more than 500 years ago? What has this culture in this country to do with our contemporary problems? Well, I think that Byzantine experience is very important for our generation. It is important because Byzantium was the only medieval state that continued throughout more than 1,000 years to be a sort of totalitarian regime. The experience of this totalitarian regime, I think, helps us to understand many features of the contemporary world. Even so, they are not generated by Byzantium, but just resembling it. Now I wish to make a turn about and tell you several words about Byzantine studies. Byzantine studies is a Cinderella among other historical disciplines, a stepdaughter of the studies of antiquity. It was born as a servant, as a housemaid of antiquity, in order to help people, help scholars of the early 19th century, infatuated with antiquity, to find some ways, some better ways to elucidate the ancient history of Greece and Rome. Byzantine law was studied in order to understand Roman law. Byzantine manuscripts were read in order to correct texts of Greek classics. Byzantine commentators of Homer and Aristophanes were used to understand Homer and Aristophanes and not for their own right. And this housemaid role of Byzantium acquired step by step a philosophical significance. Byzantium was regarded to be a simple continuation of antiquity. The word continuity acquired the predominance in understanding and characteristic of Byzantine culture. Byzantium was just a continuation of antiquity. Well, despite of this general statement, to everybody was clear that there was a very significant difference between ancient Greece and ancient Rome on one hand and the Byzantine Empire on the other. And this difference needed to be explained. And again, words were found to explain this difference. Very important words, Christianity. Christianity was the phenomenon that differed Byzantium from antiquity. Byzantium was proclaimed to be a union, a combination, a mixture of Greco-Roman culture and Christianity. This is the general judgment about Byzantium that we can find now in textbooks, in monographs, in works of most prominent scholars. Let us try, first of all, to understand whether this statement has any meaning, whether this statement really can characterize Byzantine culture. Well, let's compare this statement, this definition, with a definition of, let's say, Renaissance. Can we apply this definition to Renaissance culture? Of course we can. We can say that Renaissance culture is a unity of antiquity and Christianity. Why not? But if these two parts of an equality are the same, if both these cultures can be characterized as a unity of Christianity and antiquity, does it mean that Byzantium is equal to Renaissance? I think everybody will laugh if I propose such a conclusion.
Well,
but then some doubts should arouse in our mind. If this definition can be applied to such different phenomena as Byzantium on one hand and Renaissance on the other, is the definition itself meaningful? Isn't it just a combination of magic words that have no real contents behind them? Let's make a step forward. What the word unity means in this context? How this unity could work? The question of unity was a very important question for the Byzantines themselves. There was a central point of long theologian disputes in the 5th and 6th centuries. The question was about the unity of human and divine elements within Christ. How this union of the divine, of God and man in Christ worked. Was it a mixture or predominance of one element over another, or a combination? You see, the Byzantines asked this question. They thought about the meaning of this word. We, the Byzantinists of the 20th century, we are not asking what this union of Christianity meant. Was it a predominance of antiquity over Christian element? Was it a mixture of these elements? Was it a combination, a new form, a new culture in its own right? And here we are coming, I think, to the core of the problem. Yes, I believe that this was a culture in its own right. A new culture, a culture that was a response to the situation that existed within the Byzantine Empire. Let us try to characterize this culture in very short time that we have today. We have to ask when it started and what event can be regarded as a crucial event in the genesis of Byzantine culture. It's quite clear that Byzantium came to replace antiquity. I think this is a rare historical statement that arouses no questions. But what happened? How it worked? How it happened? Antiquity was a society based on the urban life. The city, the famous polis, was the central of the whole life. And the citizens of the polis, the citizens of the ancient city, were political animals as Aristotle defined them. They were political. I put an emphasis on this word. That means that they were first and foremost the members of the society. Their life was interconnected with the existence of their polis. They felt their belonging to the polis. They were members of the society. And about the 7th century, in the eastern part of the Mediterranean world, the crisis of the city broke out. I cannot affirm that all the cities were ruined at that period. Here or there, some of them remained. But Byzantium, unlikely the ancient world, was not a net of cities. Many cities, both in Greece and in Asia Minor, were in ruins. And what is even more important, when, after several centuries, they did revive in a medieval shape. They were absolutely different cities. What was different? The difference was that medieval city in Byzantium lost its public elements. Ancient polis, even the late polis, had any sorts of public edifices, public institutions, theater, library, public library, places for conventions, and so on and so forth. Byzantine city has only churches, no other public buildings, no other public institutions. The transference of the trade activity from the agora, from the central marketplace, to single streets and separated houses is another typical trait of Byzantine cities. So even in the outer shape of the city, we can trace this difference in the making. Let us move to the external appearance of the people, of the inhabitants of this city. Well, you know that ancient dress was, so to say, an open dress. The people were not concerned to cover their body. They were proud of their body, and their garment did not impede them to show how beautiful the human body was. Byzantium brought with its appearance a sort of closed garment, the dress that the aim of which was to cover, to close, to hide their body. Trousers and sleeves were early medieval inventions in both the West and Byzantium. Well, we may say the Byzantines borrowed trousers from the neighboring peoples, nomadic peoples, the mounted riders. Well, they may borrow, why not? But they, the Greeks, knew these mounted neighbors for many centuries before Byzantium. The Scythians of Herodotus were people who wore trousers, but the Greeks did not need to borrow. They borrowed trousers when the need of this sort of garment appeared. So they covered their body. Of course, we can find in Byzantium some voices that still kept talking about the importance and significance of human body. They had still some doubts whether this body is evil or divine. I will quote two authors. One of them was Nicetas Honiatus, a Byzantine historian who died at the very beginning of the 13th century. His opinion was, so to say, in oscillation. Sometimes he described the covered human body, the heavy garment, as an ideal form of dress, ideal from the moral viewpoint. But at the same time, he was always eager to mention the nudity, to describe the most dirty functions of human organism, to mention private parts of human organism. So he was attracted by the body, even so he was afraid of it. This was a sort of double standard, if you want. But even stranger is a position of a church writer, Simeon the Theologian, who lived at the very beginning of the 11th century, 2 centuries earlier. I repeat, he was a theologian, he was a monk, he was a hegumenus of one of Constantinopolitan monasteries. And he wrote a hymn in which he described how beautiful human body was. Of course, he described it from a theological viewpoint. He said, everything in our body is Christ. Every finger is Christ. Even my private parts are Christ. And what is hidden, he says, is especially precious, since the Son of God is also hidden. Well, This is exceptional position. But in principle, the Byzantines differed very much from their ancient ancestors just in their attitude towards the body. The idea of a covered, of a closed body was very dear to the Byzantines. Their house. Well, I'm not talking about average houses or houses of the poor. The poor lived in such houses that are available. They are not building their houses according to their taste. They just take what they can take. But who build houses according the ideas of the time are rich people. What is a rich Roman house like? Well, this, if I will use one word, an open house. It has an impluvium in the middle. That means an open roof, a roof that is open to the winds and rains that lets the water go into the garden, built up under this impluvium. The garden, the nature, is let in the house. A real garden with fountains and plants and so on. But not only the real nature, but nature of the visual art is let in. Mosaics of rich houses, of rich Roman houses, are presenting first and foremost the life of nature, plants and animals. We have much less remnants of Byzantine houses. But we have, among others, a very beautiful description of a house in Constantinople of the 11th century. And this is quite a different house. This house had three floors covered with a roof that had no holes to let water in. And there were no mosaic floors on the ground floor, but on the ground floor there was a mill moved by a donkey. The house became much less light than it was in antiquity. It is a very strange change, again, in the 7th century. Until the 7th century, we have a lot of ancient lamps dug up, ceramic lamps. We have almost no later lamps. The candle became the dominant means to bring light into the house. And of course, you can imagine that a lamp gives much more light. The house, the Byzantine house, even the Byzantine palace, was divided into smaller cells by curtains. Curtains were very typical feature of the Byzantine palaces. A curtains behind which the people who were intriguing against others hid and listened to the
conversations that were not supposed to be listened to.
The covert, the closed house is a sort of parallel to the closed dress of the time. Well, if we look at the book, at the book form of the ancient and Byzantine periods, we can see again an obvious difference between them. The ancient book was predominantly a rotulus, a volumen, a book that was rolled around a stick. And to read it, you have to hold it into hands. And the reading was always a loud reading. The change came relatively early. The change began earlier than before Byzantium. But then the Byzantine form of the book was primarily the so-called codex, the book as we have it now, the book that could be put on the table and read without holding it. And the system of silent reading appeared parallel with that. We have a brilliant evidence of the appearance of this new form of reading. And the authority is nobody other than Saint Augustine, who describes his meeting with another very prominent person, Saint Ambrose. He came to the room where Saint Ambrose was reading a book. And he was shocked because, he says in a letter, Saint Ambrose was reading the book without moving his lips. It was a new event. But what social meaning it had? Any loud reading was a reading for an audience. The people were surrounded around a person who read a book. They read it together. The silent reading was a reading for oneself. Well, not only reading, the prayer changed accordingly. A Roman prayer was a mandatory, a loud prayer. The people thought that those who prayed silently were asking the gods to give them something bad for other people. The silent prayer was a very typical feature of Byzantine monasteries. It was called intelligent prayer. And it was quite habitual. Well, the church itself, the church building, I mean, was completely different from the pagan temple. How Greek and Roman temples worked, where the believers were gathering. they were gathering on a square before the temple. The temple was the house of the gods, and only priests had the entrance allowed. But the people were standing before the temple on a square. Well, early Byzantine church, even different from the ancient temple, different in the way that it attracted people inside. The believers came inside and prayed inside the church. But the early church, despite of this innovation, was a part of the street. The early basilica is practically a part of the street cut off and surrounded by the walls. The axis of the building is horizontal. Your look goes along the earth, along the street. Yes, of course, it was an ancient street, so you had colonnades there, like normal ancient porticos. But what changed after that? The axis changed. The Byzantine church of, let's say, the 6th century already, is a church the center of which is the cupola. And the look of the believers goes up to the heaven, to the dome. So the street past of the church was destroyed. The church changed its character radically, even more. Early church service included processions of the believers who went out of the church, around in the street, went around the church in the street and came back. Early churches had different doors for these processions. Then these processions were abolished. The prayer was concentrated, the service was concentrated inside of the building that represented not the street, but the whole universe in its form. Again, the closing from the street. Well, we can compare two saints' lives. One, the life of the of Simeon the Fool, who lived in city of Emesa, Homs, now in Syria, in the 5th century. Another life is the life of Basil the Younger, who lived in Constantinople in the 10th century. And these two lives, when compared, show us quite clearly the changes that took place in the society in that period. The action of Simeon's life is in the street. The 5th century, the late Roman period, the period when the urban life was still flourishing, and where the place where he acted was the street. He went through the streets. He was a very strange person. He would drag a dead dog on a string, but he ran with this dead dog on the street. He went to look how local women were washing their linen in the in the river, everything is in the open air. But Basil's life is transferred inside the building. All the scenes are in houses, in rooms, indoors. Well, the public sight of human culture was replaced by the private sight, private form of life. So the crisis of the urban life was the crisis influence had all this on human behavior. Well, we have a very rare example of Byzantine self-description, so to say. This is a text written in the 11th century by a person whose name is Kekavmenos. We don't know anything about this person except the spare facts he gives himself. But this text is a sort of admonitions and stories. Kekavmenos, perhaps an old man at that time, gives his advice how to live to everybody, to the emperor, to the patriarch, to his children, to magnates and bureaucrats. He knows everything. Well, but this is one idea that permeates the book, the idea of necessity to be cautious. Be cautious. Everything is dangerous around you. Be cautious. Don't eat mushrooms. I know many people who died of mushrooms. Don't build your house underneath a rock. The rock can fall and smash your house. Be very careful with people, people who are above you and below you, because those who are below you today can be above you tomorrow. Never have a friend. Never have a friend. I know many people whose lives were ruined due to their friends. If you live in a house, in a city, that your friend will visit, never let him stay in your house, because he will seduce your wife and tell to everybody the secrets of your house. You see that this, we have a lot of advice of this sort in Kekavmenos, but we understand the core of this advice. Be within your family. The family is the only dependable element of society. Everything is dangerous. But be inside of your house, within your family. Be individualistic. Well, I mentioned already Simeon the theologian. He is very close to Kekavmenos, by the way, in his denial of friendship. Nothing is that dangerous as friendship. Well, what is friendship, he says? Only common routing, eating and drinking together, nothing more. He went even further than Kekavmenos. He denied the family. Alone, naked before God. This is the way of salvation. Never try to help your neighbor.
lest to destroy your own salvation. This advice is repeated several times in Simeon. This is a difference between the West and Byzantium at that time. In the West, the church as an institution was a means to save mankind. You cannot find salvation without the church. That's the principle of the Western church of the 11th century. The sacraments, baptism, are these tools to save mankind. Not that in Simeon. The salvation is your own business. Of course, he could not deny necessity of sacraments or baptism. He accepted that. But in the four, he put the vision of divine light. You have to develop yourself to such a level, then you can see the divine light individually, not with the help of church. A different approach. Well, there were various institutions in Byzantium. There were some guilds, there were some sorts of self-administration in cities and the countryside, but they never reached such a level that they reached in the West. But the family was much more important and much a stronger institution than in the West. And we have a very serious evidence. We have a letter by the Pope Nicholas I in the 9th century. That was a letter sent to Bulgarian Prince Boris, who played with both Rome and Constantinople, trying to get more for his promise to accept Christianity. So he addressed several questions to Pope, and Nicholas, among others, wrote, "The situation in Rome is much better than in Constantinople. We have here the possibility of divorce by the single wish. The people can be divorced on their volition, no restrictions." Not that in Constantinople. This is the evidence, very authoritative evidence of the 9th century. Later it changed. But at that time, in the Byzantine time, the Western family was much looser than the Byzantine. Well, we can say that the Byzantine culture had a very specific feature, and this feature was individualism that permeated all the branches of human activity. It was reflected also in their creative activity. Everybody knows that the icon played enormous roles in Byzantium. And the icon was a tool of individual relation to the saint. Well, this is clear. What is less clear is that the Byzantines looked at their icons as individuals, real individuals.
You know, we are talking always about conventional features of iconography. But the Byzantines really, they always stressed the individuality of the saint as presented on the icon. That we have many legends about icons having clear resemblance with the original. I will tell this one of these legends and stop because my time is running away. In the life of Saint Nikon, we have a wonderful episode. Saint Nikon died, and one of the men who loved him very much ordered the painter to make an icon of Saint Nikon. But the painter had never seen Saint Nikon, so the patron described Saint Nikon as he could. And the painter, the artist, started working, but the work did not went well. He could not paint the icon. And then he heard a knock on the door. And the monk came in. And the monk asked him, "What is the trouble?" The artist said, "Well, I'm committed to make an icon of Saint Nikon. Well, don't worry about it. I was always told," said the monk, "that I'm very similar to the late Nikon. So look at me and make the icon." And he looked and started painting. Then he looked again, and the monk disappeared. Well, beautiful legend. But the sense of this legend is that they really saw the individuality of every saint on the icon. So if we don't see this individuality, that's our business and our fault. We can find very interesting features in Byzantine literature that Western medieval literature of this period did not possess: the psychological depth. We have a very interesting description of an overturn, a palace revolution in Constantinople in 1185. Niceta Haniatis, whom I mentioned already, described this event. The crowd came to the church in which a criminal found asylum. And they came just because of their curiosity to see how he would be caught and punished. But the government was very idle in this case, and the crowd waited, and Haniatis described how step by step the attitude of the crowd was changing. How step by step they began to have sympathy with this man. How they began to cry that the emperor is wrong in this case. And how they finished by proclaiming this man a new emperor. This psychological change is beautifully described. We have a parallel Western description of this same event, and nothing of this kind is to be found. Well, individuality, individualism in Byzantium was a crucial phenomenon that determined all forms of Byzantine behavior, Byzantine creativity. Even so, of course, there were many contradictions, many different approaches, but what I'm talking about is the major line of cultural development. Well, where is antiquity? Well, perhaps somebody will ask me about that, and then I will answer. Thank you for your tolerance. Do you need this machine?
We're prepared to take questions if there are any questions.
Yes, sir.
How much of a Byzantine heritage belongs to the Soviet Union?
I'll repeat the question so everybody. The question was, how much of the Byzantine culture is owed to the Soviet Union? There was a loud laugh from the. How much of the Soviet culture is owed to the Byzantine culture? I'm sorry.
Well, that was the topic of my yesterday lecture. Would you like me to repeat it? I can make, nonetheless, the long story short. I think that the question is not the heritage. The question is the similarity. It is not the heritage because we cannot find a direct line on development. Kievan Rus was tremendously different from Byzantium. This is a heretic statement, but nonetheless, I tried to prove it yesterday. Kievan Rus accepted from Byzantium everything that referred to the church, canon law, service, church building, the icon again, but outside of the church life. In the secular society, there were no similarities, just the opposite. Take only the most important event, the organization of power in both countries. Nothing could be as different as these two states were. But in the Soviet Union, now, we find many, many features that resemble a Byzantine structure. I can list them, some of them at least. One and only ideology. State ownership of major elements of the land and of the wealth of the country. Meritological principle of the organization of the ruling class in theory. That means that there is no inherited nobility, and everybody can, in theory, become a member of the upper crust of society, and so on and so forth. How it worked, and why there are in some periods the totalitarian features become predominant. I'm afraid I cannot answer this question. But we can see these traits, these features, not only in the Soviet Union. We could see them even so for a short period in very Western country of Germany. And we can see them in a very eastern country of China. Perhaps there's something wrong with our time. I don't know.
Yes, sir.
There were, in Byzantium, also very big mass movements. And I think, for instance, that the factions at the Hippodrome. How does this fit in with the tendency to individuality?
There's evidence of mass movements. How does that fit with the proposition of individuality?
Well, I thank you for your question because it works only to support what I was telling. This mass movement you are hinting to took place in the 5th and 6th centuries, and they stopped to exist just in the 7th century, which I try to present as a borderline between antiquity and Byzantium. We have some very important mentions of these circus parties, the blues and the greens, as existing in the 10th century, but in what a function? There were not mass movement of these parties in the 10th century. They were, so to say, domesticated. They took part in the ceremonial of praising emperor when the emperor went to the street and walked or was carried through the city. They had their places and they had strictly determined words to accost the emperor. This is just what I wanted to say. I could not say everything.
And Mrs. Nemetz? When you spoke of the man who warned about friendships and things of that order, what were the risks?
Well, risks. The risks was a sort of instability of the situation. Nothing was stable in Byzantium. Nobody was secure in Byzantium. Even the emperor. We know, for example, that half of Byzantine emperors were urged to abdicate or were murdered or were compelled to go to monastery and so on, a half of them. We know that, in average, the length of the reign of an emperor was twice as short as the length of the reign of German emperors in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, yes. Neither the magnates were secure. Well, yesterday I told a story that I love very much and I will repeat it today. A very rich and influential magnate, Malinas by name, invited the Emperor Basil II to his estate and entertained him perhaps as well as I'm entertained in this city. But emperor was not as grateful as I am. He took Malinas with him to Constantinople. He let him live under arrest in his house. And after Malinas' death, the emperor confiscated all the riches, all the lands of the late Melinas. Had this taken place in medieval England, what would have been a result? A baronial war, of course. But nothing of this kind took place in Byzantium. So the instability is very typical of Byzantium. Well, in the same Nicetas Haniatus, whom I mentioned twice tonight, is a wonderful passage that perhaps only those who lived in the Soviet Union during Stalin's day would appreciate in full scale. He said, those who were already arrested, became calmer than those who were still at large waiting to be arrested. This is a situation.
I hope I answered you. Yes.
Somebody suggested last week that we might think of a means of having the timid ask questions who don't wish to stick up their hand and say it out loud and pass cards. I wouldn't mind having some reaction to that in due course, but I'll ask those of you who are stronger and want to put your hands up to. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering about the political significance of Byzantium with respect to the Western Christian Empire and how important it was in acting as a buffer state against the rise of Islam. Say a word about that.
In respect of the rise of Islam, how would you balance the Eastern and Western cultures? Is that the question?
Well, close.
Close. I'm sorry, I'm not doing very well today.
Well, this is a question a little bit beyond the topic of my lecture. But this is a very big and very important question. First of all, Byzantium and the West. They both had the same roots. They both grew from the Roman Empire. The scholars were inclined to emphasize the difference of their faiths and the difference of their structures from the very beginning. We used to say that in the West, the urban life ceased to exist, whereas in Byzantium, it kept existing. Well, I think it's wrong, and I hope, Jim Russell, you think it's wrong too. Even so, Byzantium was not conquered by Germanic tribes, the urban life, by very unclear and mysterious reasons, ceased to exist practically in Byzantium. So there were much more similarities than we think. Well, of course, the cultural contacts were disrupted very soon after the 7th century again. The 7th century is the century when Latin language in the East ceased to be an equal language with the Greek. The linguistic barrier was created or started to exist. And step by step, they began to moving into different directions. What was the major difference between these two parts of the European world? Well, I will say perhaps the aristocratic character of the West, one, and secondly, the lesser role of family as the major social unit. They were more social on the one hand, and they were more aristocratic on the other. Well, we have some traces of, let's say, hierarchy in Byzantium, but nothing resembling Western hierarchy. We have some village communities in Byzantium, but nothing so strongly developed as in the West. We have some later towns in Byzantium, but no free towns as in the West, and so on and so forth. In the 12th century, a Byzantine canonist, Theodore Balsamon, wrote about Byzantine monasteries. The eyewitness and the man who knew how, he was appointed a patriarch of Antioch, so he really belonged to this world. Well, he said, we have almost none of cenobitic monasteries, only some convents. Unlikely Western monasteries where monks live and eat and sleep together. Well, and so on and so forth. More sociability in the West and more aristocratic forms. And in the 9th century already, and especially in the 11th century, and then after the conquest of Constantinople, the differences came to a clash. The clash that took a religious form, the famous dispute about the procession of the Holy Ghost. What from, or from whom Holy Ghost proceeded? The famous filioque in the West, it was stated that Holy Ghost proceeded from God the Father and God the Son. In Byzantium, only from God the Father. Logos, the second person, and the Holy Ghost were described as two hands of God the Father. And we have a text of the 12th century about this discussion, very important text, I think, coming from a Byzantine theologian, Nicetas of Maronea, who was a rare case, a supporter of Western view on the procession of the Holy Ghost. And he said, well, look at the relationship, the emperor, the general, and the soldier. If the soldier is obeying to the general, does it mean that he is not obeying to the emperor? You see that this image reveals us that the question, the dispute was about hierarchical structure. The Western world was hierarchically organized, and it was desirable to create the image of the Trinity according to this habitual feature. And in the totalitarian Byzantium, everything was under a single father. So that came to a clash, and this clash had very tragic result, as you know. Now about the Islam. We have to distinguish between two Islamic waves. The first was the Arabic wave that came in the 8th century, well, in the 7th, but this is in the 7th and 8th century, we can say, and was stopped almost simultaneously in the West at the Battle of Poitiers and in the East at the Battle of the Acroin. And so the West and Byzantium played the same role in stopping the Arabs. The second wave was Turkish wave. I have to add a couple of words to about the Arabs. Well, the Byzantine Empire learned very soon to get along with the Arabs. There was a sort of a neutral zone between them, the zone of very strong cultural exchange. We have beautiful examples of mutual cultural influence that was very productive for Byzantium too, and for the Arab lands as well. Quite a different story is the second wave, the Turkish. Again, we can distinguish between Seljuks that could collaborate with Byzantium and did collaborate in a sense, and the Ottomans that did not, who destroyed Byzantium. Well, we can only guess what happened if Byzantium did not resist the Turkish invasion. Well, but after the fall of Constantinople, when the Turkish Empire reached its peak, there was no Byzantium to resist, and nonetheless, very soon, the belligerent spirit expired and they were stopped. But this is really a sphere of guesses. Well, I think that Arab influence was productive in this. After this period of wars, but the wars were between England and France, also very long wars. But after this first period of wars, they started to live together. There were many people in Byzantium who were bilingual, Arabic and Greek. There were many translations from Arabic. It was very serious, very important influence of the Arabs on Byzantium, and vice versa, too. So this sort of Islam was not politically dangerous after the 8th century. But the Turkish, the Ottoman invasion, brought the end of the empire. So it's a very, very difficult political question. Yes.
I'm almost afraid, I wouldn't mind a short question, but it would be a shorter answer. I think that would be. But let's have one more. Yes, John?
No, I can't.
That question qualifies both in the question and the answer. I think what I'll do then is ask Professor James Russell, who's a member of the Classics Department and also a member of the Committee of Senior Fellows at the Dumbarton Institute, where Professor Kazdan lectures, to thank our speaker.
Yes, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have already recorded your appreciation
to Dr. Kajdan for his stimulating address this evening. It only remains for me to single out a few points that I would like to make and ask you to record that thanks in more formal manner. I dare say that most of you, myself included, coming here expected a somewhat different type of lecture on a subject such as Byzantine culture. I suspect many thought there might be some pictures on the screen and we might be looking at scenes of Hagia Sophia or icons or some of the famous artworks of that great civilization. We got something quite different and something very special, I think. We learned about the significance of a society that wore trousers and sleeves in contrast to the flowing togas of the Romans, or a society that used candles instead of the much more luminous oil lamps of antiquity. And these contrasts, of course, are paradigms. And that, of course, is the very essence of history. It's from these paradigms that we make general conclusions about history. And that is where we have in our presence a very, very distinguished scholar who can make these contrasts and draw the general conclusions and make them meaningful, not only for those of us who are Philhellenes and love the world of ancient antiquity, to be reminded in a very salutary way that this civilization of Byzantium was the one that mediated this civilization of ancient Greece and its literature to us. This is a fact that we often forget. It was one that Edward Gibbon was very conscious of, and in fact, European scholarship until the 18th century was always very conscious of. It really was a phenomenon of the 19th century that this memory has slipped away from us, and we ought to be reminded of it constantly, that Byzantium was every bit as important to our heritage as the medieval West. And even more important, of course, is a reminder of the very great importance that history has to offer us. And this is very salutary in our very parochial society, which too frequently sees history as something of a frippery and irrelevance. And here we have tonight, in these paradigms, all sorts of references that we can judge for ourselves and think about for ourselves in the open, reflections on the open and the closed society, issues which are very, very close to the political problems of our day. And one last point I would like to make, and this is a somewhat more personal point before I ask you to deliver your vote of your thanks. I first met Alexander Kajdan, must be about 6 years ago, 5 years ago. And at that time, his English was halting, and he had real difficulty in communicating. 5 years later, he has stood in front of an audience of some 500 people, and he has held your attention and enthralled you and has clearly commanded your respect for his intellect and his great learning and knowledge. And for this accomplishment, as well as for the lecture itself, I would ask you to join me in a hearty vote of thanks.
Thank you very much.
On just reminding you about next week, we have Professor Peter Larkin speaking to the topic, How Salmon Find Their Way Home. And on that point, I'll move the meeting adjourned. Thank you very much. Good night.